Hello and welcome to Deep Dive MH370, Episode 25, Breakthrough Part 2. I'm Andy Tarnoff. I am the publisher and founder of On Milwaukee, a daily magazine and city guide based in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And I'm once again joined by Jeff Wise, aviation journalist, MH370 expert, non-conspiracy theorist, and author of The Taking of MH370. How's it going, Jeff? Are you ready for this one?
Well, we certainly have been promising big things to our listeners and viewers. So I'm excited. You might notice that I was wearing a tie last week. I was so excited. And my wife said I look like a dork. So I'm kind of back in my normal clothes. I'm trying to just keep it real.
It is a very exciting episode because last week we did promise that we have some important new evidence to share with our viewers and our listeners. And it is a total double dose today because we're going to drop two big pieces of information. We keep talking in this podcast, we're 24 episodes in, about how we're building stone by stone upon a story that takes a long time to unravel.
Yeah.
And, you know, people ask, are you ever going to figure out the mystery? Jeff, I would say yes. Today, we are going to announce that we figured it out.
Yeah, I mean, you can cut it different ways. But yeah, I mean, the point is basically, look, this is a complicated mystery, and it requires a lot of attention. And attention is something that's in very short supply these days. People want a quick answer. Where's the plane? And then they can forget about it. This isn't that kind of story. It's not that kind of mystery. It is technical. In order to understand the meaning of things, you have to have a background. We took a lot of time last episode sort of laying the foundation for using Lepus barnacles as a timing device. And that is going to pay off today. We're going to talk about some evidence that we found, some new data. And only with that foundation is it going to make any sense. If you just tell somebody what we're laying on you today without any kind of, you know, run up, then it just would mean nothing. So, but what we have, I think, is very meaningful. I hope it will have an effect. We've actually got two things that I think together are even more powerful. The narrative needs to change in this. I hope that the narrative changes today. It's 10 years and it's time to wake up.
Yeah. In fact, this episode will run on March 7th, 2024. And that is 10 years to the day, at least in the United States, of when MH370 took off and disappeared. So here we go.
Yeah.
All right. First, we are going to tell you where the debris from the plane came from.
That's right.
That's a biggie.
And that's a big deal because, you know, Andy, you and I were talking about this before. When the first piece of debris washed up, the Flapperon, it had these barnacles growing on it. And the expectation was that this was a piece of evidence that was going to help solve the mystery. First of all, it was the first physical evidence that this plane had gone into the Southern Indian Ocean. Before that time, all that investigators had was this mysterious Inmarsat data that had never been, that they'd never had to deal with anything like that before.
Yeah.
And what was more, it had these Lepus barnacles on it that could provide clues as to where the pieces had floated from. And that would tell you where the plane went down, and that would help you find the plane, and then that would help you solve the mystery.
The second major bombshell we're going to drop is we are going to tell you why the Australians made a major mistake in their investigation of MH370.
That is a very cryptic way to put it, but I think we should be cryptic because, again, it's going to be an important development that I hope will change the narrative, but we also don't want to give too much away because, you know, well, Andy and I sometimes has fights about what's called the inverted pyramid, which is like newsmen, journalists are like, tell the people what they're going to read and then tell them again. And that's great for newspapers where people, you never know how far into a story someone's going to read. So you have to give them the important stuff up front. If you're talking about a discussion or a narrative or especially if you want it to be entertaining, you kind of have to unroll the story. You know, you have to tease a little bit.
Well, we've been teasing for 24 episodes. So I would say that, however, I want to point out that this is kind of a standalone episode, Jeff. So this is going to be the one, given the timing and the media surrounding this, that many people are going to be seeing for the first time. On the other hand, we also have to honor the traffic, the visitors, the listeners, the readers, the viewers who have been with us along this entire ride. Yeah. So some of this is going to sound like the first time people have ever heard it, and some of it's going to sound kind of familiar. I still stand by the fact that this is a pretty big episode, and I'd like to jump into it if you're good at that.
I don't think it's going to be, I don't think it's repetitive if you're familiar with how we've come so far, nor is it going to be baffling if you haven't. It's like one of those Marvel movies where, like, it's not just fan service. We're, anyway, I don't know if it's an analogy.
Well,
but you get what I'm saying.
Yeah, I will say that if it does sound sophisticated, the show notes are going to have a lot more information. So this is going to be one of those episodes where you're, after you listen to this, you're going to want to visit deepdivemh370.com, because yeah, we'll also be sharing some documents that we will be discussing in a moment.
Yeah.
But let's start with the topic that we set up for people last week.
Right.
The idea is that you can use Lepus Barnacles as a clock for timing the age of things, right? And we learned about a researcher in the Maldives who had found the Lepus in the tropical Indian Ocean, and that they can grow to be 35 millimeters long in 105 days.
Right.
Take it from there, Jeff.
Okay. So trying to use Lepus as a clock, knowing that the clock can run to 35 millimeters in 105 days, but not knowing if that's as big as they get. Maybe the barnacles on the Flapron only got to be 36 millimeters, because that's as big as they get in that particular branch of the ocean. Well, and this is our big reveal. The big reveal is that we have some new data. We basically found a Rosetta Stone. We found data that shows what happens if you go longer than that. And it's somewhat rudimentary. It's somewhat fragmentary. It's like, you know, when you find an old papyrus scroll, you don't necessarily get everything, you get the part of it that you get. So let me tell the background story.
Okay.
Back in 2013, a Perth businessman and fisherman named Stephen Knight was on a fishing camping trip up in the northwestern corner of Australia. And this is kind of really rugged, semi-uninhabited, kind of wild terrain. And he'd gone up, it's like 1,000 miles. I think people in this neck of the world are like very rugged, outdoorsy, adventure-y, and like kind of think nothing about taking their boat.
That's a long trip on a 26-foot motorboat, in my opinion.
Yeah, it was an eight-meter boat. But anyway, regardless of what a adventurer Stephen Knight is, he went up there and he was camping on the island, and a storm came, and he was okay. He was on the shore, but his boat got pulled from the anchor. The anchor was like kind of nestled in like not such deep sand, and it got pulled by the storm and it got flipped, and he lost his boat. And so he himself was okay. He went home and went about his life, got some insurance money.
Yeah.
And that's all he knew. And then 8 months later, he gets notified. The police in this island called Mayotte, which is sort of out way, you know, near Madagascar, not too far away from some other islands we've talked about, like Réunion, Rodriguez, etc. This island is called Mayotte, and it's part of France. And the authorities, somebody took pictures of this boat upside down on the beach. And they're kind of low resolution and not like great pictures, but it was kind of an interesting story that this boat had made this journey, and it was in some different publications. And I became aware of it. I think a reader of my blog turned me onto it back in like 2015. But one of the images is close up enough that you can see not only some of the barnacles pretty clearly, and this will all be on the show page, but you can also see these registration numbers. And so, Andy, when you reached out to me and we started doing this podcast, I started, you know, going through all of my old research and all of my old notes. And I came across this and I thought, this is something that I never really fully investigated.
Yeah.
And so I always had a sense of like, if you've got these things, they must have a known dimension.
Right.
You should be able to figure it out. And so I didn't know how to do that though. And so it took me a while. I reached out to Stephen Knight, who's a great guy. He was very helpful. And he reached out to the manufacturer of the boat that they were able to tell us the exact dimensions of these numbers. And then I had to like kind of figure out the geometry. I did like a little report that I'll put in the show notes. Anybody who wants to look at it certainly can and should. I figured out the geometry of the, so you're looking at these things at an angle, so their apparent size is not the same as their true size.
Yes, that makes it a little bit more complicated. There's perspective to deal with.
So I reached out to a bunch of people who do this professionally, and they were like, this is complicated.
It's hard math, Matt.
I mean, I hope that our listeners or viewers or readers will be intrigued enough by this to want to like reproduce my work and see if they agree with me. I'm confident enough in it that I'm like sort of advertising it as a big breakthrough. The upshot of all of this. Oh, and then I built a model in my living room just to make sure if I could recreate my math in the real world, because I think that's more kind of intuitively convincing.
Mm-hmm.
But so to make a long story short, the biggest barnacle, I think, in these in this image is like 40 to 42 millimeters, like minimum 40 millimeters, maybe 42. There's a whole bunch that are like, you know, 37, 38-ish. And there's only a couple dozen barnacles in this entire image, altogether in this image. And we talked, did we talk last week about population effects? Or maybe you and I were talking offline about
it. I'm starting to lose track of what you and I talk about and what we talk about in the podcast. But no, I think that we only talked about population effects insofar as we talked about the height of people in a classroom versus a college campus.
Did we talk about that in the show or offline?
We talked about that in the show. So you can probably elaborate a little bit more.
If a couple dozen, imagine like, so having a couple dozen samples of barnacle is like having a classroom. Like imagine the tallest kid in your class is probably like a little bit taller than average. But if you go to a large university, the tallest people are probably significantly taller than that. So the Flaperon is like a university. It had hundreds and hundreds of barnacles. They collected over like 400 barnacles, and they didn't seem to imply that that was all of them. Like there were many, many barnacles. And so if the biggest was 3.6, and then you have this other sample that's only a handful, and there's a bunch that are bigger than 3.6, and there's one that's like 40 to 42 millimeters. It really suggests that these animals do keep growing. Like 3.5, 3.6 is by no means the biggest size.
And if this isn't obvious, we're using these standardized numbers, this registration of which we know the exact dimensions off the photo to use as a key, as a reference, as a scale for the size of the barnacles. That's what makes this such a unique photograph.
Right. And so what I'm trying to do right now is find higher resolution pictures. And Stephen Knight was very helpful in helping me kind of try to work backwards to talk to the insurance company. The insurance company actually was very helpful. They told me that they don't have them. I talked to the West Australian police. They don't have them. But so now I'm reaching out to the Mayotte police. So we'll see somebody obviously took these pictures, and I feel like nobody really deletes pictures anymore. So
no,
they must exist. So I would love to get like a much bigger like population off this.
You're a very tenacious investigator, Jeff. And so we did this in conjunction because you built the physical model in your living room, which is a very impressive art project. I went the other direction.
Jank, but I think it gets the job done.
Well, I went the other direction and I did some intense photoshopping with perspective warping to match up the registration numbers on the before and after picture. And
I appreciate your doing that.
So there's two different ways that we are confirming the size of these barnacles. And we freely expect people to say, you're wrong, which is why we're actually making these files available and saying, go ahead and try it your way and see if you agree as well.
Yeah. Well, and I'd like to address like how crazy this claim is, because I think it's very unsurprising. And let me just elucidate the claim a little bit.
Yeah, go on a little bit more.
So we know that the Flaperon had a bunch of barnacles that were like 2.5, and then there was one that, or maybe more than one, that were 3.6. But 3.6 was the largest size on the Flaperon. We also know that a researcher in the Maldives, who we interviewed last episode, told us that he had grown, his average size was 2.8 and his biggest was 3.5. So that suggests that if we're using the size of these barnacles as a proxy for how old or how long a piece has been in the water, 3.6 should be similar to like 105 days, AKA 3 to 4 months. The piece that washed up in Mayotte had floated across from east to west in 8 months. And by the way, I should say this is about the same water. So one of the things we discussed last week is that if you're going to use LIPAS as a measure of how long something's been in the water, you need to calibrate it with something that has been in the same water.
Right.
Very similar ocean, because it all depends on temperature, nutrient density, and stuff.
All that stuff.
And so this is as close as you can get. The Maldives actually were further away, and they were on, and they were growing on moorings, which could be different from floating things. They probably don't grow as fast, actually, in the, under those circumstances.
Okay.
So all of which is to say that this boat that washed ashore in Mayotte should be an excellent baseline. It should be an excellent Rosetta Stone for figuring out how quick things grow. I wish we had more data. I wish we had pictures that were larger and more detailed, but we have what we have. And if it only serves as a prod to ask more questions, I think that's great. It's what this seems to be telling you. We teased up top by saying we're going to tell you where the pieces of debris came from. And the reason that this is something we should really care about is when the authorities saw the flapper on, they were like, okay, we're going to use that to work backwards through reverse drift modeling, which we've talked a lot about, and we're going to know where these pieces started out. The assumption was where they started out was the site of the plane crash. They could then search the seabed and find the plane and solve the mystery. What we're saying is we're going to tell you where these pieces came from, and what we're saying is they didn't come from the plane crash. Okay, this is our big, crazy statement. We're telling you that the evidence that we found tells us that the Flapperon did not float for 16 months. It floated for maybe certainly less than 8 months, maybe considerably less than 8 months. We're basically saying what we call there's a debris gap of about a year. There's a year-long gap between when the plane went in the ocean and when these things started to float. Now, that's a big, big claim, and we're going to sort of unpack it a little bit before we move on to other topics.
Yeah, right? I wonder if there's a different, yet another way of saying this in like a sentence, because the capsized boat piece,
yep,
their longest barnacles are over 40 millimeters,
right,
4 centimeters.
Yeah.
And that was in the water for how long?
8 months.
Okay. The pieces on the Flapperon were found after 16 months?
16 months. So twice as long.
And there was really nothing on that that was larger than 36 millimeters?
The largest one was 36 millimeters.
Okay.
3.6 centimeters.
Okay.
So that's a problem. Now, I actually just today I got an email from a marine biologist who studies this exact topic, the growth using LIPAS as a measurement of time in the ocean. And he was talking to me about growth curves and how it's really hard to figure out a growth curve. And you know what? We don't need to have a growth curve. We just know that things get bigger as they get older. Doesn't matter what the rate is or thing. All we know is that if it's smaller, and especially if you have a population that's smaller than another population, that's much more robust than just saying these two, because individuals can grow at different rates.
Sure.
If you have an entire population, that seems pretty robust.
Yeah. So when we were talking about this and you were fully, fully breaking down to me your model in my Photoshop work, yeah, I asked you if the biggest barnacles on the Flapperon could have been eaten before they were discovered.
Right. And so let's anticipate the objections that people are going
to
make.
Because that was the first one that came to me. Like maybe some of those ones were just eaten off and we didn't see the biggest of the biggest of the barnacles.
Well, that's exactly right. So there's a funny thing about, you know, using there's been a lot of interest, especially since MH370, but even before it, of this idea that, well, since LIPAS grow at a certain rate, let's use them as a clock. And this has been applied, and it's that itself is not a controversial idea.
Right.
Size correlates with age, and you have to calibrate it based on the waters that it's in. Where it seems to get controversial is when your results make you uncomfortable, right? And so it's like, it's fine to say that like a 3.6 piece is younger than a 4.0 piece, but the minute you say, oh, this is about MH370 and it implies that the plane didn't really crash in the water, people are like, well, no, there must be a perfectly reasonable explanation. There must be something we're missing, because it can't possibly be the case that the plane didn't crash in the ocean. I'm saying, well, this is what the data says. And you can try to come up with alternative explanations. And that's fine. You know, let's just understand what the data tells us. And And also, let's see if this repeats. Like, is this just a one-off? Is just the Flapperon weird? Because yeah, strange things happen in the world all the time, and you could have outliers. You could have black swans. But here's the amazing thing, Andy, is that the Flapperon is not unique at all, right? In fact, as we've talked about, there were some 36 pieces of debris that washed up. And okay, most of them didn't have anything on them because presumably they'd been like ashore. Most of them were picked up by Blaine Allen Gibson, and he found them like in Madagascar, and they were like above the high tide line, and who knows how long they've been kicking around. But but some of them did have Lepus barnacles on them. And one of them was washed up in Mauritius. And I want to really read you the details from the report. This is from a report called Summary of Analyses Undertaken on Debris Recovered During the Search for MH370. This is from the final report that the Australians put out. This was a piece that washed up. It was discovered in March of 2016. This is 2 full years after the plane disappeared. It says a large number of barnacles were found on the external section of the door. The barnacle species present was Lepus anatifera, which is the same thing we've been talking about. 11 barnacles were found, 11 adult barnacles. That's not a lot. The biggest of them was 20.05 millimeters. Okay, this is less than an inch. This is significantly less, significantly smaller than the Flapperon. And they were so young that even, so they said, the size of the largest barnacle present corresponds to a growth rate of approximately 45 to 50 days. I think that's really conservative, actually. This is based on Evans' 1958 data, which, as I
right,
say, is
which
like
we said has
not
some holes
source.
In it anyway, but yeah.
We have more up-to-date data than that. Actually, barnacles can get to 20 millimeters in a couple of weeks, to be real. But they conservatively called it 45 to 50 days. 105 days, like at the super end of the temperature spectrum, which it was, yeah. Doesn't really apply. Point just being, here we have a whole nother piece. We give a lot of attention to the Flapperon because it's the famous one. This piece on Mauritius is like, how do you make sense of this?
Okay, you still didn't answer my question, though. But I think you did in a roundabout sort of way. I said, right, could the biggest barnacles from the Flapperon have been eaten before they were discovered?
Right.
And I think, if I'm not putting words in your mouth, you're saying, well, yeah, maybe they could have been. But then you go and look at all these other pieces, and they are consistent with the size of the Flapperon. So unless you're saying that all the big barnacles on all the pieces were eaten in the same sort of way, like,
it's kind of a probabilistic process.
Thank
right?
you. Yes.
It's if you have, like, say someone, you know, bequeaths you an acre of forest, right?
And I hope that
and
happens.
Know that it like was cut down like some number of years ago, and you want to know how long it's been since it was cut down. You could go out there and you would measure the size of trees, you could compare it to forests elsewhere. And I'm sure there's a, you know, Cornell probably has a chart of how fast this given species of trees grows. And you would measure them. And look, you might say, well, look, the average height is this, the tallest one is that. And someone might say, well, maybe a beaver like chewed down the tallest tree. And you'd be like, yeah, maybe they did. But like the second tallest tree is probably almost as tall as the first highest tree. When you've got a probability distribution, it's pretty robust to individuals getting knocked out.
Exactly.
And so, yeah, if you take only a dozen individuals out of a very large sample, it's going to skew you. You're not going to have the outliers, especially, but you should have more or less the same average. I'm not a statistician, as any statistician can easily immediately tell. But I think this is the point. And again, this gets back to the idea that this method is fairly robust. The idea of using Lepus as a measuring tool is uncontroversial until you apply it to MH370.
Right. This only sounds cockamamie in the context of the magical fairy dust disappearing plane. Yeah. Otherwise, this would be like fairly straightforward marine biology.
This idea of the magical fairy dust is that, you know, time and time again, we see that the evidence tells us something. And then you hear this response of, well, I'm sure that there must be a perfectly reasonable explanation. We'll talk more about this later. This is kind of going to be a recurring theme of the episode. But yeah, this idea that, like, in the case of MH370, the evidence that seems to tell us something can't possibly be telling us that. There must be a perfectly good explanation.
And yet, every piece of this debris points us into the same direction. So let us review the points here. We've got Lepus on the trailing edge.
Okay, we did a whole episode talking about how this piece, and you know what, I think we came across a video since then that shows, like, very vividly how this thing floated.
Yeah.
And it floats with this end sticking up out of the water. Like, things do not, water living creatures do not grow like that.
Okay.
That's one.
Okay. Number two, the failure of CSIRO. I call it CSIRO. Does anyone else call it CSIRO, or does everyone else call it CSIRO?
CSIRO. I don't, you know, right, I'm going, I don't really use CSIRO. It in conversation. Like, I would say, like, the Australian.
Okay, so the Australians are their failure with the Flaperon drift modeling.
Right. So when they did the drift modeling, they could only get it to work if it was floating high up in the air and being pushed by the wind. And
which would not.
But it couldn't have floated high in the wind. It couldn't have floated. You know, as Jim Carlton was saying, something had to be pushing it down.
Right. Then you got the failure of CSIRO, Australia's Muscle Bay drift modeling.
Right. And so, again, it's like their model did not predict that this piece would get to where it wound up in the time that it did. And again, you could just say, well, you know, there's uncertainties. The ocean is a mysterious place. Drift modeling is just an approximation. It's not always going to give us the right answer. To which I would answer, well, yeah, but it never gives you the right answer. You know, the idea of using drift modeling is pretty uncontroversial and seems to be pretty robust and worthwhile.
Yeah.
Except it doesn't work when it comes to MH370.
Okay. Point four, the fact that all of these specimens, Muscle Bay, La Reunion, they all just seem to be a few months old. This is for what we just talked about.
Yeah, they all seem to be a few months old. They also don't really have the right organisms in some case. Blaine's piece that he found, No Step, when they looked at it, it had these species that were pretty old, but they don't live in the open ocean. So what the heck?
Yeah, how'd they get there?
And there's another piece I want to mention that's really intriguing, which is the Mossel Bay piece. Now, this was the piece that washed ashore. Somebody took a picture. It was covered in Lepus. And then they didn't want to pick it up because it was smelly and probably pretty gross.
Right.
So they washed back out to sea. And then 3 months later, it washed back ashore in the same place, which is pretty incredible. Then it got picked up. And so they were able to measure it and take the dimensions. So what we have with Mossel Bay, the authorities didn't attempt to do anything with this, but I think we can do something. And this is where I would love to invite the readers to pitch in, because I'm sure there's people out there that have this particular set of skill.
Yeah.
Which is, we have a picture of this piece that's really quite high resolution in bright light, so you can really see what's going on. But it's at an angle, and the piece itself, I think, is kind of curved.
Yeah.
So even though we have a second image with a tape measure next to it, so we can see exactly how long and big everything is, we've got a great reference on the size. To get the first picture to match the second requires some morphing.
Yeah, I did it. It's hard, but there are people out there who are even better than me.
You can, like, put a point on each.
Yeah.
Like, you put, like, 100 points on one and then 100 matching points on the other, and there should be a computer that can just kind of, like,
yep.
You know, like a shrink form plastic, just make one fit the other.
It's doable. It's just a little bit outside my skill. But I pulled it off, and I got the results that you were talking about.
You can just look at, like, a very local piece if there's, like, a part of it that's very local, and you can see. I think the biggest piece is, like, 2.5 centimeters, which is very much matched with a Mauritius piece. It would be even smaller than the Flaperon. And again, it tells us, like, it's not what you would expect to find. One of the things I was talking to Jim Carlton about was this idea that when pieces go in the water, when you have a whole population of pieces go in the water, you tend to see the same effects, right? If they drift through a similar patch of ocean that's inhabited by the same kinds of species, they will pick up sort of the same kinds of species, and they will grow at a similar rate. What we have with MH370 is nothing, none of that. Nothing is the right age. Nothing is the right species. So the Flaperon, we're sort of putting an upper bound on the Flaperon at 8 months. It's probably closer to 4 months, frankly. which means that it would have gone in the ocean in around, let's see, count backward from July, 4 months, like March of 2014. Yeah. So there's about a year before the Flapron went in the water.
Is that when the plane crashed?
Let's talk about Mauritius. Mauritius was a very conservative maximum growth age of 105 days. That's 3.5 months. This was found 2 full years after the plane disappearance. So this one, there was a gap of about, a year and 9 months, 1.75 years, right?
Okay. Yeah, and we touched on this, but the tone set by David Griffin from CISRO, it's just weird to me. Like you had an email exchange recently, right?
Yes, I did. He's actually been pretty good about taking questions from journalists, even though he's obviously like pretty much annoyed.
I'm sure he's very annoyed.
But he's a good sport about it. I'll give him that. So I reached out to him. I emailed him. I said, "Hey, can I ask you some questions?" He said, "Sure." So I ran up a whole bunch of questions all at once. I wrote to him. I said, in 2017, you wrote to Victor Iannella, which is a name we've heard before. So Victor had asked him about the arrival time of the piece in Mossel Bay, which, as we've just pointed out, is pretty. First of all, the barnacles are too small. And secondly, no one can figure out how it got there so quickly. He said, I consider Roy, it's called Roy, the Roy piece, because it has the word Roy from
the Rolls Royce. Yeah.
I consider the arrival time in South Africa before anything else upstream to be something that is simply too hard for any present day model to convincingly explain, which is basically like, yeah, we don't know, you know, shrug.
Fairy dust.
And I said, has your view changed since then? And he wrote, no, because of the word convincingly.
Fairy dust.
What does that mean? I don't know. It means like we can explain it, but just not convincingly. I mean, again, it's like, this is a mystery. It's like we're shrugging our shoulders. We can't explain it, which is fine if it's one piece, but with every single piece, it's like, yeah, we can't explain it. Okay, let's move on.
So we have just unveiled why we...
Wait, can I talk about more?
Are you sure. I want to talk about
how crazy this is.
Go ahead.
This is the heart of the matter.
All right.
Everything is crazy. I'm starting to try to reach out to relatives because I know people want to know what happened to their loved ones.
Yeah.
And I think they should understand that all of the evidence that indicates that this plane went in the water is super dubious. Okay. Most people, when they hear that their pieces of the plane washed up, they were like, oh, okay, well then it must've gone in the ocean. I'm saying, hold your horses. When you look at these things in detail, it looks super sketch. So I do want to take just a minute to go through it. So we just did Mossel Bay. Now, I also asked him about the barnacles growing high and dry on the trailing edge of the Flapron.
What did he say about that?
I said to him, I've shown several marine biologists images of the Flapron floating in the test tank in Toulouse, as well as the pictures of the CSIRO's cut down Flapron floating in the ocean. They all agree that Lepus barnacles could not grow high out of the water like that. Do you have any explanation for this apparent paradox? This is what he said. Simple. The Flapron was in the ocean, not in a tank. No wind or waves in the tank, obviously. At sea, this Flapron flips over readily in moderate sea and wind states. Okay, granted. And this is a great place to put up that video that we talked about earlier.
Yeah.
You can see for yourself how this thing flips around. It's still sticking out of the water. It's flipping this way, it's flipping that way, but the trailing edge is out of the water either way. Maybe it gets splashed. But a splash is not enough. It's like, imagine that, I was thinking about, imagine you went on a cruise and they were like, okay, your cabin is like actually just below the waterline. And you're like, well, below the waterline, I'm going to drown. And they're like, yeah, but from time to time, the waves will like,
just go, take a deep
go
breath.
Down and yeah. take a breath. Every time yeah. the wave goes down, just breathe. You'd be pretty unsatisfied. And a Lepus barnacle would be unsatisfied for the same reason.
Okay.
Okay. This is a good one. I pointed out to him that if the piece is not floating high and dry, their drift modeling doesn't work. I said, do you have any way to resolve this paradox? He said, have you made a typo? I see no paradox. The trailing edge, which in the flotation tank sat high above the water, with its trailing edge high out of the water, he's like, I guess what he's trying to say is like, I see no problem with barnacles growing high out of the water because they get splashed. Okay. This is a good one. I said, does the CSIRO ever consider leaving the Flapron in the water to see how biofouling would occur? This is basically, I think, a really simple way forward. Let me tell you what his answer was. He said, yes, but this would have been a long-term, difficult, and probably ultimately unconvincing experiment. This is what kind of drives me crazy, because they had a replica flapperon. They actually had a bunch of replica flapperons, and they put them in the ocean, and they were probably covered with, like, you know, instrumentation, and then they
stopped.
They took them out. And I said, like, just leave it in there.
Yeah. You know, again, you're the science major from Harvard, and I'm not, but as my recollection of how experiments go is, a bad reason to not do an experiment would be to say, we don't think it's really going to do anything. That's why you do the experiment.
I completely agree, Andy. And I hope that somehow we can convince the authorities or some interested third party to do this. I mean, people study stuff that grows on research buoys. That's what Cynthia Venn did. And it would, it's just not that hard to put, like, the NOAA here in the United States, they have like thousands of these buoys that they let drift, and these buoys are sending them data all the time. It wouldn't be that hard to just let one go and then, like, pick it up. It's like, you might have to go out of your way, or maybe you ask somebody who's nearby to pick it up for
you. That's kind of like what you do in science. You do
That's
hard
what
things.
You, do in science.
You try, like, things and see what happens.
And especially in a condition like this, where nothing is matching what you think.
Right.
This would be a great excuse to get some government budget money and say, we need to really understand how Lepus annotifera grows in the ocean. And if Jeff Wise's claims are really off base, or we suspect that they're off base, or he doesn't have enough data, let's get more data. That's what a scientist does.
Yeah.
A scientist, if he has a question that he can't answer, his next step is to think, okay, how can I get the data? How can I answer this? How can I resolve
right.
this? Let's get some data.
But I'm telling you, as devil's advocate, you know, the scientists are saying, I don't really care what Jeff Wise thinks. So, you know, that's why this podcast needs to build a groundswell of people who do care, particularly loved ones. And I mean, you got to change your mind.
I did an interview with CBS Radio here in New York on Friday, because in preparation, I don't know if they're going to run it. He sounded pretty skeptical. I explained to him, like, we're going to be releasing some information that indicates that this plane didn't go that there was a year long gap between the plane disappearing and the stuff going in the ocean. And he's like, that sounds pretty out there. You know what that sounds like? I said, that sounds crazy. I know. But, like, listen, you can't. I mean, this is going to be sort of like one of the big take homes of this entire episode is, you can't just, you know, make your decisions based on your gut feeling of what seems plausible. And if you're getting results that you don't like, you can't just say, well, then we should stop looking because we don't like these results. And that's exactly, Andy, what the CSIRO and the Australian government writ large did.
Yeah.
They started to get results that didn't match their hypothesis. And instead of checking it out, they shut down. They said, you know, there must be a perfectly good explanation for all of these things.
Yeah.
But we're not going to try to find out what that perfectly good explanation
is. No,
was.
We're not. And let's take our little pause here, because I see you getting increasingly fired up on this topic that you spent 10 years of your life working on.
Going to cool me down a little bit.
I'm just going to cool you down, because we have a second half to this.
I didn't even, I mean, listen, I, there's...
Is there, you know, some more stuff you want to talk about? Before, or else, I mean, I've got all the time in the world.
Suffice to say that of all of the problems with all of the pieces of debris, maybe I'll put it in the show notes, or maybe nobody cares. There's multiple things about the debris. None of it makes any sense. None of it matches the 16-month time span. And so I think we have to deal with it. You know, if there is a perfectly good explanation, then fine. Tell me what it is. If you need to do some more research, if you need to release some floating, you know, test objects into the water, do so, because what you're looking at is potential game-changing paradox, which is what I think it is.
Let me try to make you smile before we talk about the second part, because your wife called you a dork for wearing a tie in the last episode.
Yeah.
And then I said, oh, well, I'll wear a tuxedo for this episode. And then I put on my tuxedo and I thought,
what happened to your tuxedo?
I'm absolutely not doing that. Like that. But what I am going to do is put up on the screen this photo from Halloween 2016, when I decided to impersonate a Delta pilot in complete accuracy. And that's just, so you think you're a dork?
And you just got out of jail, right? Didn't you just get released from federal penitentiary?
I grew a
it's
mustache,
a shame you crashed
dyed
that plane
it black.
That was not good. Not a good joke.
That was a game-worn uniform. I made a fake ID. I had the little epaulets. And
it's pretty epic.
I still did not win the On Milwaukee Halloween costume. So I'm very bitter about that. Yes.
Who won?
I don't know, some Harry Potter or something. They never let the boss win. God. It never happens, no matter how hard I try. So just in case we need it for any simulation, I have a complete pilot's uniform from head to toe, and I think I could probably get on a flight deck and then get arrested.
Noted.
Let's pause here while we do our mini interstitial, because this episode, episode 25, is brought to you by Ditch GPS. It's a new sponsor for us.
This is very exciting, and this is a great... I'm so happy that our friends at Ditch decided to support the show like this, because it really fits in a way. Let me tell you what Ditch is. It's an app that uses historic GPS data. Basically, boats have a location positioning, a position reporting system similar to the ADS-B that we've been talking about for planes. And they accumulate all this data, and so they can show you how people take a route from here to there. So if it's a great for planning your trip by boat, if you want to see how have people done it in the past. And this is especially useful for people who are in unfamiliar water or don't have a lot of experience in this particular area. For instance, if you go on a bareboat sailing trip down in the Caribbean, this is a really popular thing. And you might want to go to this port over here, and you don't know where the reefs are. And you can see historically, well, how have other people done it? And
right. It's not like a turn by turn navigation, you know, Google map. It's more about like crowdsourcing these routes that other people have done, where they've paused to, you know, look around for stuff underwater or go fishing. Like it's more comprehensive and more robust than just a go this way, turn left.
It's very scientific. It's just the location data, the tracks of people, what people have done before you. And so if you're thinking, well, I'll go through this channel, and you look and nobody has done that, it's a really good thing. These guys have, by the way, they've got a great website. You should definitely check out.
It's at ditchnavigation.com.
Ditchnavigation.com. And they kind of, they'll walk you through it. And you can sign up for free and try it and just play with it, which is a great thing to do before you buy the actual app.
Yeah, so there's a free web version. And then, of course, there's the app for iPhone and Google Play as well. So we're super excited to have them on board.
I mean, it just seems
25.
Like a perfect match because, you know, we've been using, we're trying to use data creatively in order to reduce a mystery, to get rid of a mystery. And these guys are kind of doing the same thing in a way. They're using this data that exists. They're using, I don't know what the technology is, AI, it's way beyond my pay grade.
Those things,
But in order to prevent people from coming to grief, they actually put together a pretty funny, well, funny for us, not funny for the people in the video, but people like running aground. I mean, it's like such a nightmare if you've sunk all your money into a boat and then it's like, you hear this, my dad was a big sailor, and like the sound of a boat going up on a rock in Maine is just like the worst noise you can imagine. So if you can avoid that, that's a very useful thing to do.
Okay. Thank you, Ditch GPS. And
thanks, Ditch.
If you are interested in being a sponsor of Deep Dive MH370, information on our show page, and you can also just email me at andy@onmilwaukee.com and we'll talk about it.
Awesome.
Okay. There goes your sorbet, your palate cleanser. time to get back into it, because now we're on to part two. The second major bombshell. And that is, if this plane did not go into the ocean, could it have gone somewhere else?
Okay, we need to take a beat, because wait, what? We have just made a kind of a crazy claim. We're saying that there's a year-long gap between this plane disappearing into the night and the pieces of it, actual pieces of this plane, starting to float into the Indian Ocean. So what are we saying happened in that year? These pieces were somewhere, but we're saying it wasn't in the ocean.
So I thought that was obvious. I thought that people realized from our from the first half of this that we're saying like these pieces aren't, this doesn't match up. Where'd the plane go?
Okay, so what we're saying is if the plane had gone into the Southern Ocean, there would not have been a year long gap. Therefore, it didn't go into the Southern Indian Ocean.
That's what I'm saying, yes.
And maybe this is what you're talking about with redundancy, but like we just want to like make it totally clear.
Okay.
There is an alternative to the plane going south. And we did a whole episode with Ken Monroe. And I talked to some other cybersecurity people who have a particular interest in aviation. And I'm getting the same thing again. And we talked to Todd Humphreys, who is a professor of aeronautical engineering at the University of Texas at Austin. And he reinforced what Ken said, but he really went further. So I wanted to share with you the conversation that I had with Todd.
The idea here is that we have exhausted all of the easy explanations for right. where the aircraft could be. And not only have we exhausted the easy explanations, we've done so in a fairly methodical way. The scientific team from Australia looked at the data from Inmarsat, and not only they determined that there would be this probability distribution for the aircraft should be found. And there was a high degree of internal consistency in those data that they analyzed,
right.
such that it wasn't, say, terribly noisy. It wasn't unpredictable. Things moved along the trajectory in a way that made sense right up until the end. And then X marks the spot and the aircraft was not found at the spot.
Right.
And that is really intriguing to me. I mean, I thought of the many ways that they might have made errors in their determination of that spot, maybe because of biases in the measurements. But as you pointed out, and as I thought about it again, they're able to measure these biases fairly regularly with this aircraft during the 7 or 8 pings that they got from the aircraft and from other aircraft. So they know about the turnaround time when they send out a ping from the Inmarsat and they have some delay in the electronics at the aircraft, and then it comes back. If that's a time variable delay, that would be something they would know about, even right. in the case of these 7 or 8 pings to the Malaysian airliner. So it's just puzzling. It really is, because it looks like a soluble problem. It looks like the amount of information that the investigators had access to was sufficient. It was also internally consistent. And yet here we are. The original search area was found not to have the aircraft, and an expanded search area was found not to have the aircraft. So that just leaves us with this puzzle where we say, now what do we do? What assumptions do we question now?
I talked to them back in 2014 when they first announced how they had done this calculation, and they essentially fully expected to send the boats down there and to find it. I've talked to people that worked inside the search effort. They were pretty shocked that they didn't get it. They had set their probability, their sort of Bayesian prior, as the possibility of that this data that they were basing their calculations on had been tampered with in some way, at essentially to zero. They just mm-hmm. didn't consider it at all. And I think the reason I'd reached out to you with this description of this potential vulnerability was to raise the question of, is it really zero? I mean, mm-hmm. for all of the complications and difficulty and expense and just unlikelihood of it, is it physically possible?
So one of the interesting facets of Bayesian estimation is that you must update your priors when you are faced with new evidence. The failed search was new evidence. And so if I'm going into the search, before conducting the search, I'm looking through all of the data, I'm seeing its high internal consistency, I'm looking at how difficult it would be to consistently fool the sensors involved, the satellites involved, and I'm assigning a fairly low probability to any, say, strategic actors mm-hmm. working to manipulate the data. But after a failed search, you have to, again, recalibrate. And you ask yourself, okay, given that the search failed, do I revisit this assumption that there was no chance the data were manipulated? And I think it is entirely scientific to revisit that assumption and to say, let's open up some areas of inquiry. The trouble with applying Bayesian thinking in a really dogmatic way is that sometimes you preclude the possibility of even looking for data, looking for evidence, because you have very strong priors against such evidence. And so, you know, whether it's UFOs or missing aircraft or whatever, it is important that you keep your mind open as far as what sources of information you'll even contemplate looking at. Right. And I think by this point, we've been pushed into a corner where we do need to revisit some of those very low assigned probabilities about data manipulation.
You know, you and I had been emailing about the kind of the difference in mindset historically within the aviation industry and the cybersecurity industry between the kind of the safety mindset and the security mindset. I was wondering if you could kind of elaborate on that.
Yeah, in so many applications, you find that there is a safety mindset that is concerned with, say, tragedies caused by Mother Nature, and then a security mindset concerned with tragedies that might be caused by adversaries, humans who are planning, who might have true evil intent. And what's interesting to me is that sometimes these two mindsets are at odds with each other. In the world of aviation, for example, it was a safety mindset that got everybody saying our ADS-B messages, the ones that each of the aircraft send out every second or so, need to be unencrypted in the clear. We don't want to have any requirement that somebody pass them through a cryptographic test, because we have to allow the widest possible distribution so that any pilot can tap into them. The safety mindset, right. But the security mindset says, hold on now, if you allow for unfettered access to these and you aren't authenticating them, you aren't tacking on a digital signature or something else that would allow you to trace back the message to a trusted source, then you're ignoring the security mindset and you're allowing people to broadcast these ADS-B messages falsely and to create the impression of false aircraft. So I just use that as an example. It doesn't really have much bearing on this case, but it shows you that sometimes they're at odds with each other, because the security people might say, hey, we've got to have a digital signature. And the safety people might say, oh, but I don't want the additional length of my message. That'll lead to more collisions in the message space. And I don't want people to have to worry about false alarms.
Makes sense. And I actually see this dynamic played out again and again. One of the aspects of MH370 that really surprised a lot of people was the idea that there was this unlocked hatch to electronics bay. A lot of people thought, why would you leave an unlocked hatch? But from a safety perspective, if there is a problem that needs to be addressed urgently, you don't want to have somebody rummaging around for a password or something.
Yeah, definitely. Usually safety wants more unfettered access. Access in extremis. So in moments of panic, you want to be able to get to it and quickly. Right. Whereas security wants to identify you, check your credentials, and slow down the process to avoid it being some bad actor.
I was speaking to a security consultant named Ken Monroe, who's out of the UK, and he was making the case that as the world becomes more interconnected, the Internet of Things becomes more integrated into our world, that an awareness of cybersecurity specifically is being more implemented in aviation. He talked about electronic flight bags and all the different ways that things are interconnected. There, you have to have some security now. You can't just have it wide open.
Well, I would say that the DNA of the Federal Aviation Administration in the United States has always been one of the safety mindset. They have, from their very beginnings with the collision over the Grand Canyon, they worked from crisis to crisis to try to root cause every accident and find out what happened. And in all of these, up to, say, 9/11, it was a safety issue and not a security issue. After 9/11, they had to embrace more thinking about bad actors, and they took steps like to reinforce the cockpit door and more protocols for ensuring that the infotainment system of an aircraft was totally disconnected with any of the command and control of the aircraft. But I would say that safety mindset is one that has a great deal of institutional inertia within the Federal Aviation Administration and across the board with ICAO and other administrative bodies. And I see this in some of the, in the resistance, say, to update systems for fear of safety problems, even when those systems are proven to have obvious security vulnerabilities. So just recently, since September, there have been many cases of GPS spoofing of aircraft. But it would be almost impossible to update the software on these aircraft, the GPS receivers, or on the integration flight management computers without a full review of the software, without the software passing all of its certifications, because the certification is required for safety. And so
right.
we are almost perversely willing to accept the obvious and present security risk, because otherwise it would mean rushing the safety.
Right. But at least the awareness seems to have been growing for some years now, thanks in part to work like yours, where you were able to use GPS spoofing to actually steer a boat, right? Back that was back in 2013. So mm-hmm. we've had over a decade now of awareness of these problems. The MH370 was a 777 of a really different generation. Its architecture was built on this data bus called the ARINC 629, mm-hmm. which I understand is essentially like a kind of hardwired internet. And once you're on it, I don't think there is any security protocol. It's like being on an internet with no passwords.
Sure. It's like being on a local area network that you fully control.
Right.
And the assumption is that if you are on the network, you have authorization to be on the network.
So if you're in, say, the electronics bay and you patch into this data bus, there's nothing to really to stop you from doing anything.
Yeah. I physical access to the cockpit has historically been the way that you prevent any, say, network attacks to the cockpit.
Okay.
But if you have access with these older aircraft, if you had access to the cockpit, you had plenary access.
Right. And
you were root.
You're root. And in this case, not the cockpit, but the electronics bay where all these things
sure.
are located.
That's yeah. right. That's right. So outside the cockpit, but it's the electronics bay that they would have had access to.
Right. That's a kind of a stunning, it's a kind of a stunning revelation. I mean, I think people have said, well, you can't do this, but it's very hard to say you can't do something if, you know, these things are essentially wide open systems. To shift from a safety to a security mindset, to acknowledge that things are possible and hence need to be guarded against, you are the first step to any kind of mitigation is acknowledgement that the problem exists.
Yes. And I think there's a real lesson to be had from the GPS spoofing since September of last year. As I say, it's not like it was unknown to the community. When this began to happen, people knew what it was immediately because they had been warned for more than a decade. I and other researchers have been saying that this is a problem. This is a wide open barn door.
Right.
But nonetheless, when it happened in the wild, there was still some shock that the fallback mechanisms, in this case, it was the inertial sensors, could also be corrupted. In other words, it wasn't the fact of GPS spoofing that shocked us, but it was the follow-on, knock-on effects that it had throughout the cockpit that shocked us, and really awakened people to the idea that there is kind of a difference between the theoretical knowledge of the potential of a threat
right.
and when it actually occurs. And then facing that and recognizing that you had perhaps let your guard down for years when you should have been more assiduous in addressing that threat.
But if you've got an unsolved mystery involving 239 people,
yeah.
then maybe it's time to say, listen, we can't put a 0% probability to malicious hacking. Malicious hacking does exist. There seems
sure.
to be a plausible attack vector here. It's time to sort of change our attitudes.
Yeah, and I would say it's past time to change our attitudes on this one. Not only has a decade passed, but so far as I can tell, nothing new has been revealed since around 2017, 2018.
Yeah.
So we have a puzzle on our hands, an unsolved major aviation accident, and we dislike those because they don't allow us to adapt.
Right.
We've got to learn from the mistakes, not just tweak a few things and move on.
Right.
And that has been the historical strength of the aviation agencies, is that they don't let any accident go to waste. They learn everything they could.
So I think that what he's saying to us is really going further than Ken Monroe.
Yeah.
Ken Monroe said this vulnerability exists. It is possible. This plane, you know, and this to me is, I think, really worth underlining. On the night that this plane took off from Kuala Lumpur, it had an unusual combination of traits that made it possible for a hijacker to make it look like it went south when it really went north. And that is pretty wild if you think about it. Like, it sent off this like really unprecedented packet of data that in any other plane would have been accompanied by information that would have made it exactly clear what happened to this plane. So the fact that it like rided right on the edge of mystery is so, should raise suspicions right there. Anyway, Ken just said that it was possible, but that he probably didn't think it was done. Todd goes further. He says, look, the fact that this is possible and the fact that the official search has failed together means that we have to look at this in a different way. We have to open up our range of possibilities. We have to seriously look at the spoofing possibility. And I think, and one of these things, you know, we've talked about it before, which is that people who only know about the Inmarsat data, when they see the weirdness about it, they take this idea, this MH370 ferry dust comes back into play. It's like, well, we know that it went into the Southern Indian Ocean, so there must be a logical explanation. At the same time, the people who know about the marine life, they see all this weird stuff happening, but they know that the Inmarsat data says that the plane went into the ocean 16 months ago. So they say, well, there must be a perfectly good explanation. If you know both of those things, if you know that both sides of the equation have all of these paradoxes and require collectively across this whole range of evidence, saying, shrugging your shoulders again and again and again and again because of all these paradoxes. Whereas, and I had said to Todd Humphreys, like, you know, there's really no evidence that the evidence that this plane went in the ocean is very problematic. And that's when he started to think, okay, well, maybe we need to really look at this. So I'm hoping, Andy, we've made big promises to our viewers and listeners that this is a big episode. We're going to change the game. And I hope that we can do this by combining yet another nail in the coffin of the idea that there's anything reasonably sane about this debris. And also pointing out that in combination with Todd Humphreys, a very respected researcher who's been looking into this very topic for over a decade, and say there's a troubling gap and there's an explanation for this troubling gap that we really need to look at.
Yeah, and we're not done yet, because let's look at some of these holes. And if you've watched or listened to every one of these episodes, you probably know all of these, but I think it's worth recapping in case you haven't. These are just some of them, right? So it's point one, it was a coincidence that the plane had a very specific vulnerability that could have been exploited in this way.
Right.
If it was a coincidence, it was a lot of different coincidences.
I think this is like a point that like very few people have gotten their heads around. And if you do get your head around it, it's like very disturbing.
And then there's this whole like, well, the SDU was rebooted.
Nobody can explain why there's two parts here. Nobody can explain why someone would want to reboot the SDU. And the other part of it is that like most 777 pilots that I've talked to, like, don't even know that this is a thing that you can do. I mean, you'd have to have really done some research to figure out how to do it. There've been various, you know, theories, that we're actually going to talk about in a future episode. One like very popular theory posits that the pilot turned off the entire electrical system in order to not leave some tiny little clue. And first of all, it's the 777 is an all electric plane. If you turn off all the electricity, you have a non-functional plane, right?
Right.
The second thing is that you would try to avoid leaving some tiny clue. The plane was flying over a Malaysian Air Force base. It's like it actually was not being subtle at all.
Yeah, and you're talking about the Green Dot Aviation guy who has millions and millions of views in his YouTube video. And I think it was very well done. And as soon as I asked you about it, you said, are you forgetting the part that the reason he turned the SDU back on was because he turned on the power because his servers were overheating? But oh, by the way, if everything was turned off, why were the servers overheating? Yeah. I was like, oh, okay. So that's like a whole episode that we want to talk about these alternate theories, but nobody has come up with a good explanation as to why
they haven't come up with a good explanation. And again, you tend to get this is part of the MH370 ferry dust where like any big, there's massive problems that just get papered over. And I reached out to the guy who, the young man who made Green Dot, and he's like, I was like, because he titled it what Netflix got wrong about MS-370.
Yeah, I said, what did
we get wrong? He's like, because you didn't pay enough attention to the like most reasonable explanation. I was like, you think it's reasonable, but you don't know your walls that you think are solid are actually completely ridden with termite.
I'll just keep going. Nobody can explain why this wreckage wasn't found on the seabed. I mean, this is a big, huge one, right? This is a failure that nobody's really reckoned with. I mean, they spent $350 million
in all
this time.
Here's the 90. There's a 99% chance of, if you get all the possible things that could have happened to this plane, 99% of their probability distribution will lie within this area, and it's not there. And they again, Andy,
fairy
this
dust.
Is the shrug.
Yeah.
This is the fairy dust. This is the, you know, what I call reasonableism. It's like there must be a reasonable explanation. And people like Green Dot made this whole video without grappling at all with the fact that, yeah, they didn't find it on the seabed. And people who are, and I am in the minority, I think, of people who look at MH370 and aren't completely convinced that it went into the ocean. But nobody, and there's various attempts to deal with it. There's various attempts to identify this perfectly reasonable explanation, but they're all pretty wacko in my mind. And I think we've already dealt with some of them, so I won't rehash it here. But yeah, this is the fairy dust.
Okay. There's no explanation of why this captain, who had no red flags, would do this. I mean, the best you can find is his flight simulator.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm not saying that there isn't, maybe it's a little weird, but I mean, I wouldn't call that an explanation.
The flight simulator is far and away the most compelling piece of evidence. Somebody came at me for saying that, and I was like, well, listen, I'd say it's the most. I don't think it's compelling at all.
Right.
The fact that it's the most is like a very low bar.
And watch that whole episode.
There is nothing. There's literally nothing else.
We spent two whole episodes on him, on Zahari, both him as a person and the flight simulator. And I don't think it's confirmation bias. We don't find it to be very compelling mass murder, suicide at that diabolical level.
Yeah. Again, you get this sort of thinking that's like, well, the human mind is unknowable, which is true.
True.
But again, it can be boiled down to there must be a perfectly reasonable explanation.
We should call this episode Fairy Dust, although that would probably confuse the people who saw it.
Well, we had
expected
it, we had it
part one. Yeah. Okay. The next one is, one single guy finds most of the debris, and he has deep and extensive connections to Russia.
Yeah,
that he lies about.
Yep, just a coincidence.
I'm stopping short of calling, and I don't actually believe that Blaine Allen Gibson was a high-level Russian spy. But after everything we talked about, I think he is at least a low-level Russian asset. And this is, I mean, this stuff is just weird.
Yeah, listen, I mean, if you want to disagree, go listen to the episode, because we lay it all out. You know, we're not just spitballing. We're not just like shooting from the hip. We have documentation for everything we say.
Yeah, that was, some people are like, that's character assassination. I'm like, those are his own words. That's his own stuff. All we did was, we said exactly, like, that's not libel. That's not slander. That's like rereading what someone has said about themselves. But I mean, maybe he's telling the truth. I don't know. I just, at best, maybe his story is just like,
let's say
super
something
crazy.
Libelous.
But hey, this leads to the next point, which, oh, by the way, Russia just happened to shoot down one of Malaysia Airlines' 16 sister airplanes 4 months later.
We're going to get into this a lot.
I mean, what I have after that says, and so on. I mean, you know, we got 25
so
episodes.
Again and again
now.
And again, you have to shrug your shoulders and wave the fairy dust and say, well, there must be a reasonable explanation. And again and again and again and again and again and again. And it gets pretty frustrating. And then come to find, imagine that the data means just exactly what it says. You don't have to look at it upside down and backwards with squinted eyes through a mirror. You can just look at it straight. Imagine it's telling you what you think it's telling you.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine that this stuff didn't go in the ocean until after a year, because it was put there. And imagine that it was clearly put there by somebody who had access to the real plane. So imagine that someone had access to the real plane because they took it to Kazakhstan and they had carried out this spoof that Todd Humphries and Ken Monroe warn us about. Imagine that somebody on board the plane rebooted the SDU for a very specific reason, which was to create a trail of electronic breadcrumbs that would mislead investigators after the fact. Imagine that the fact that the plane isn't on the seabed isn't because of some triple crazy, unlikely set of circumstances, but it's just not there. It's not on the seabed because it didn't go into the Southern Ocean. And so what you have is that all of these paradoxes go away all at once if you just take them at face value.
And I think if you think we're just pulling this out right now because you're a new visitor, you can just go back. And we've spent hours and hours on all of these parts. I mean, there's an episode on Kazakhstan and the route to get there.
Yeah, it's taken us – we've spent 6 months of laying the foundation for what we're saying today. And we're not done. I mean, there's much more to be said, and we will be saying it. And so we invite you to join us on that journey. But like,
yeah. So I just say, so after 10 years, we've arrived at a point where there's an absolute mass of evidence that points to Russia as the culprit of this. And the only way you can make all this evidence go away is just by closing your eyes and pretending it's not there. So now I'm going to put you on the spot, Jeff.
Okay.
10 years after this flight disappeared, 6 months into this podcast, 10 years of your career, your book. Yeah. Excellent book, by the way. Your participation in the Netflix documentary, the Kindle book, you eat, sleep, and breathe this stuff. Do you think we've solved the mystery?
I think that the accumulation of evidence is such that I think we can say what happened to this plane. I would like more evidence. I wish we had the weight of official investigative resources behind us to look into it. I would like a community of people to be weighing in and moving the ball forward. But I just don't think that there is an alternative to a spoofing hijack. There's just no evidence that the plane went south. There is substantial evidence that the plane went to the north. It's mostly negative evidence in the sense that all of this stuff about the evidence that went south is so basically nonsensical. I would like to have more positive evidence that it went north, and I certainly will be working to try to get that. But I think if you understand all the evidence that exists in this case in a holistic and detailed manner, I think it's impossible to reach any other conclusion than that this plane did not go south.
For what it's worth, I agree with you. I think it's more about negative evidence than positive evidence, because we don't know. We're not allowed to go traipsing around Kazakhstan and look for stuff. I don't think we know we don't yet know the details of what happened to that plane. It's like we've painted a portrait and we're just working on the hands now, like the face part.
Yeah. It's
pretty
not
good.
Finished.
Yeah.
It's not finished. It's like it is a work in progress. It's not done. But I think that you can, even though, like, you know, if you're painting a portrait, you might not have finished all the details, but you can see it's a portrait of George Washington or whatever.
Yeah.
And so, yes, work remains to be done. And I think it's going to be interesting. I invite new listeners and viewers to come with us on this journey. I hope our existing listeners and viewers will continue to come with us and help. As I said, it's like we need help from people. And I think people's voices will also help too. You know, it's going to take like letters to the editor. And I don't, maybe somebody will start a petition or something, but it's really important. One of the things I want to talk about in this podcast, and we have been talking about, is not just what happened to this plane, but what we can do with that information. And I think it's to convince people how important it is that we do something. We need to grapple with this. Our future is at stake.
Yeah, you know, that's something we have yet to really talk about. And this is the part I'm most interested in. As I love the true crime angle, I love the investigative journalism angle, but just as a citizen of the world, I want to think about what the implications are if the Russians did take this plane. I mean, this isn't just a crime of brutality. This is showing a level of sophistication of the enemy. I mean, this should be very scary to people, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the things that really motivated me back in 2015. It was scary to risk my reputation by saying that, like, we need to consider the possibility that this was a hack, because it implied to me, it was a terrifying prospect that we were being attacked by an antagonist that was so ruthless, so sophisticated, so clever, so much more intelligent, frankly, than us, than we, the West, that even though I was trying to tell people that this was a possibility, people were unable to deal with it. They were unable to grasp the possibility. And this meant we were 100% vulnerable. And to make matters worse, Andy, frankly, my worst fears were borne out. Like, the Russians really did carry out a wide-ranging, ruthless attack against Western liberal democracy and capitalism, and to try to install kleptocrats, oligarchs, all around the world. And they were remarkably successful. And this is terrifying. And the war is going on.
Yeah, so this is terrifying. And if you put it in historical context, right? So we're talking like 2014. It was just 2 years later that verifiably the Putin regime did everything he could to affect and possibly successfully affect a U.S. election.
Yeah.
I mean, people, I hope people's memories are not so short to have forgotten about Cambridge Analytica and the Russian troll farms and how we use social media to sway opinions and fake news back when fake news actually
Russia,
meant
if
something.
You're listening, I hope you find their emails.
I mean, like, this is stunning, stunning shit. And it was right at the same time that this was going on. It was right at the same time that Ukraine was being invaded for the first time. Yeah. And it's still going on. So I got like, now I'm on my soapbox, right? You're going to have to calm me down with the story. But just in the last few weeks, a Russian agent was arrested for trying to get Biden impeached and using like GOP proxies to make it happen. Okay. So this guy, Smirnov, which is a good name for a bad guy, he's got felony false statement charges and obstruction crimes for he allegedly provided false information about Joe Biden and his son.
Yeah. Which became the basis of the impeachment charge.
Yes. So these Russian operatives got the Republicans on this like phony story about Burisma and bribery into an impeachment scandal. Like, this is going on now.
It's going on now. And look, we're going to keep on peeling the onion. I think we've laid enough on people today. But just to give you a taste of what's to come, this isn't just about a plane disappearing. This isn't just about the relatives of 239 people who want to know what happened to their loved ones. But this is a case that affects the whole world. We're going to explain to you why that is. We're going to talk about the implications. But this is a 10th year anniversary, and I hope that people will realize that this is and should be a turning point in this case.
Yeah, now I got all fired up because I'm not just
keep
angry.
That fire.
But,
keep
I'm
that
not,
fire.
I'm just angry. I'm not just angry about the past. I'm angry about the present, and I'm angry about the future. And there was one comment that really stood out to me in our YouTube comments, which, again, my God, these are phenomenal comments. Yeah. And we're so honored and humbled by the fact that so many people are participating in this podcast. But one of our longtime viewers said, "Hey, guys, watch your tone. You look a little giddy when you talk about some of this stuff."
Yeah.
And we took that to heart because this, you know, we want to be engaging. We want to tell good stories and we want to be interesting, and that means sometimes we have to smile and joke and stuff, but this is very serious stuff. And someone else said, you're just doing this podcast to exploit victims of, like, whoa.
All right, well, you can't listen to trolls.
No, but I want to acknowledge the fact that just talking about a tragedy in an engaging way doesn't mean that you're being insensitive. I think the most sensitive thing we can do is solve this mystery.
Well, there are people, Andy, who don't want this mystery to be solved.
And other than Russia, who's that? I don't know.
Putin,
for one. Right. Or maybe he does. I don't know. I mean, who knows?
Maybe he would want somebody to appreciate his work. I have thought that, actually. But we need people to care, and we need people to understand.
All right. So here's our message today on the 10th anniversary of the disappearance of Malaysia Airlines flight MH370. It was unusual. It was weird. You might be tempted to tell yourself that there's a simple, reasonable explanation. By believing that, it puts yourself in danger. It puts the whole world in danger.
Right.
As of this recording today, Jeff, this podcast has been viewed about 50,000 times and listened to more than 250,000 times.
That's insane. That's wild.
I'm happy about that. I'm glad I reached out to you on Twitter, and I'm glad that we made this thing. This is the time when I must encourage you to visit deepdivemh370.com. Tell your friends, like and subscribe to this podcast. You're helping us get here, and you've helped us get here. And we'd like to thank Ditch GPS for being a sponsor of episode 25.
You,
super cool. We would love to thank Jacob John, our Seattle Tacoma singer-songwriter, for writing our theme music, which just makes me, that does make
it's
me
so good.
I'm, going, I'm not going to lie about that. Yeah. We got a week full of media appearances and promotion, and then we're right back at it again, Jeff.
That's what we do.
Thank you.
But thank you to everyone. It's 6 months for us. We have more to talk about, a lot more to talk about. There's more layers that I need to peel, but thanks for sticking with us. Thanks, Andy, again, for your all your hard work and your good cheer.
You as well. Thanks, Jeff.
All right.
Bye-bye.